offered with comment. Offered with comment, a half-hour program with Professors Arthur Wills and Thomas Mutch of the University of Alaska Department of English. Each week at this time, the hosts of Offered with Comment discuss with their guests outstanding literary selections. Now here is Professor Mutch.
Since Dr. Wills and I are recording this program during Christmas vacation, when students are not too readily available, we're going to conduct this discussion ourselves without any guests. The novel we've chosen for today is Joseph Conrad's Nostromo. It's a rather difficult novel to try to sum up, so I think perhaps I might best introduce it by reading an excerpt from Albert Gerard's introduction to the set of Conrad novels put out by the Laurel Editions. Gerard says, "Nostromo remains Conrad's richest creation of life. His few days in South America a quarter of a century before, the reading of a book about Paraguay, a few stories and personal memories. These seem to be all Conrad needed to bring into existence his Republic of Costaguana, as substantial and real a place as any we can hope to visit. The imagined state and city have certainly a great reality, a greater reality than Bangkok or the Bornean villages Conrad actually knew. And there is a far more impressive range of characters than in any of his other novels, from chiefs of state to the florid person of French extraction and mistress of the finance minister who sells her influence, from Father Corbelan, austere head of the church and the country's first cardinal archbishop, to Father Roman, great snuff-taker and card-player, who had shriven many simple souls on the battlefields of the Republic. From General Barrios and the backwoods General Montero to the craven Colonel Saltillo and the craven Señor Hirsch, various personages seem entirely new to Conrad's fictional world. The loquacious politicians are always convincing. So too are Mrs. Gould and Antonia Avellanos, the first interesting white women in a work of a man who showed much misogynist distrust. Perhaps the major disappointment of the novel in terms of characterization is Nostromo himself, the Capataz de Cargadores, an idealizer of his own vanity. Charles Gould, who sacrifices everything to the idealization of his silver mine, is a pallid figure, but such he was intended to be. The very number of vivid characters and incidents and the impressionistic structure of the first part makes Nostromo the most difficult of Conrad's novels to begin. The narrative flows backward and forward in time with the waywardness of casual memory. Only about a tenth of part one exists in the present. But perhaps that will give you an idea of the structure of a novel such as this, which does spread out over a whole country and such a vast range of characters. The novel, I think, interests me mainly in the way in which it evokes the number of characters and makes them play out political roles, as if Conrad is trying to write about the sources of politics and of political situations arising out of individual personalities and conflicts.
My feeling is that the novel is difficult, Tom, because the purpose is never really defined. I also feel that the political situation here is purely ancillary. True, you have political intrigue, political agitation, but I don't feel that Conrad is commenting on the revolutionary tendencies of certain South American countries, nor do I feel that he's trying to arrive at a definitive explanation of political motifs. I think all of this is just a kind of paraphernalia which gives him an opportunity to conceal characters and then probe behind the mask which he has given them to wear. Basically, he's still the psychological novelist interested in human motives, especially in motives that perplex the characters themselves.
Well, I think he's got some then here that don't quite come off, because as Gerard mentioned, Gould remains shadowy and doesn't quite emerge as we feel he should, even though this seems to be a fairly important element in the novel, that Gould's idealization of the silver mine as the bringer of civilization and of an established order is the greatest thing that he can do with his life. This we see mainly through Mrs. Gould.
It's also a violation, isn't it, of a Garden of Eden. This is actually what the fictional country is. Progress is introduced, and we have a biblical parallel very strongly implied. For example, when I believe it's the doctor who's commenting on the San Tome mine from a distance, remarks that you have introduced a number of snakes into the country, as though it's responsible for bringing in serpents into a Garden of Eden. Now, let's examine, if you will, for a moment, Charles Gould's motives. Are they purely altruistic and humanitarian, or do we have, at the same time, a kind of greed here?
Well, obviously, there is a greed, a kind of a self-glorification more, I think, than greed, because greed would imply that the only reward he was after was surely one that could be measured in money. I think this is an urge for self-glorification.
Isn't it true that his preoccupation with the mine is a way of alienating him from his wife? And Conrad is basically concerned with the separate polarities of this alienation. Why cannot they be reconciled? And as a matter of fact, he gives one of the characters an expression to this effect, commenting on Charles Gould, that he, quote, felt the remorse of infidelity. Now, he's obviously quite chaste, quite pure in regard to his marriage vows, but it's as though the mind had become a kind of concubine, leading to an alienation from his wife, and neither of them knows how to reconcile this estrangement.
But then isn't this rather intended as a balance, too, for the for Nostromo and Linda in the latter part of the book, particularly since the silver again figures in this, and it's Nostromo who is destroyed by the silver?
But do you feel that Gould's ideals are so inviolate, or are they perfected to the to some utopian ideal? I have a feeling it's just an obsession with him, and that he's just as much interested in profit here as he is in certain, well, let's say, humanitarian zeals. As a matter of fact, the journalist accuses him of being a sentimentalist, of deliberately disguising the real motives of his real interest in the mine.
Well, here I think Conrad's technique has something in the to do with the way in which we perceive these things. Just as there is this rather wonderful structure in the first part where we move forward and back, and we open with the scene of revolution. And the first part, if you recall, closes with the previous revolution that had led to this glorious president dictator. So we end on a high note at the beginning, but we have opened at the close of that same period with the revolution succeeding revolution.
Isn't his characterization of Charles Gould also a kind of indictment of all British colonials? Aloof, austere, impeccable, reserved, and for all of his humanitarian interest, quite an inhumane and not a cruel person, but let's say
unfeeling
person.
Yes,
this is brought out in his relationship to his wife, who is of course just the antithesis of what he is.
And yet, interestingly, they're both English in background, and yet the behavior, this coldness that Gould displays, is always commented on, or not always, but often throughout the book, as being the way the English are, typical English behavior.
I think it's quite interesting that Conrad remarks that she fell in love with him because of his interest in desolate, isolated mines. And when he had an opportunity to inherit one, this crystallized their engagement. And yet, from that moment, you might say there is a subsequent deterioration in their relationships. They do grow farther and farther apart. And I believe that Mrs. Gould, at least, attributes it directly to his preoccupation with the mine. I remember when, in the novel, when Nostromo is dead and she is giving consolation to the young girl, Giselle, she says to Giselle, "Console yourself, child. Very soon he would have forgotten you for his treasure." It's as though this is an inverted comment on her relationship with Charles, that in the process of his greater and greater attachment to the mine, she has been forgotten. But she is not a whining malcontent. As a matter of fact, she's one of the more admirable women to be found in Conrad.
Yes, well, this I think is one of the main comments to make about Mrs. Gould, who, to me at least, seems to become the dominating character in the novel, even more than Nostromo himself. Her presence or allusions to her are continually occur and seem to affect everything that happens. But we have the wonderful picture of a woman who is warm, who has feelings, and is willing to be unconventional. The descriptions of the Spanish women, of course, being aghast at her, and particularly her own venturesomeness in going up to the mine when they're first starting operation, and she follows the whole process and then follows the first load of silver down to the docks, and when it's safely ready to be shipped, then she retires to town.
Isn't she a typical Conrad creation, however, in that publicly she must wear a certain mask, must pose in a sense, and I'm not saying here that that it's altogether gratuitous. She is a warm, affable person, and yet she is, as Conrad says, quote, the most solitary of women, the most desolate of people. And that's what he is interested in, I think. Not so much in how she masquerades publicly, but he's interested in probing the cause of her isolation. And again, he traces it directly to the mind.
Yes, and how she masquerades to herself,
yes.
Actually. I think this is one of the ways in which Conrad does work with these characters, and and manage to keep such a great range of them going, in that each of them not only has the public mask, but he's also masquerading to himself. He's trying to convince himself of certain things. And we begin, first of all, with the kind of dedication that Gould has, that even old Giorgio, the Garibaldian, has turned himself into part of the public mask. And we begin to suspect that here and there, the real person underneath has faded away. Too much energy is going into a masquerade that has to be maintained for himself. I think the thing that impresses me here is the brief flurry during the revolution, when at moments of stress or under any tension, he looks up at the portrait of Garibaldi. This is his only identity in the world, and he's completely dependent upon the ideals that he'd fought for under Garibaldi.
Do you feel that Mrs. Gould has an identity, say, that Charles Gould does not have? Is it just what she shows to the public, the real self? Now, what I'm getting at is, I'm wondering if Charles Gould is really worth knowing. I think she is, but I have a feeling that he's somewhat of a lightweight.
He always appears to us in the novel in circumstances where we can only see him as a man of action. I think this is one other thing that's interesting. Conrad, who loves to probe thoughts and motives in his characters, tends with Gould, I think, more to show us action rather than thought. And particularly the forceful manner that carries him off when he is trying to raise the capital to open the mine, reopen it, and develop it. In each case, he's dealing with other people, and the scene itself shows us his confidence in himself, but we don't probe his motives beyond this this idealization, the idea that the mine will bring law, order, progress of all sorts, and that this is all there is to do with his life.
In his case, though, don't you feel that it would be a mistake to take reticence for wisdom and reserve for diplomacy? I have a feeling that this is all he is. It's just a reticent, reserved, lightweight Englishman involved in a situation that he doesn't altogether understand.
Well, I don't think that he's intended even to be any heavyweight intellectually. Even to the way in which he acquires the obsession with the mine, we find that he finds himself in situations and he must deal with them. And he deals with them directly and rather forcefully.
I think in no character in the novel do you get this feeling of guilt from masquerading as you do in Nostromo himself. Now here is to me the most interesting person in the novel, and I don't at all agree with the chap whom you quoted there that he is an incomplete character. I find him very complete because he is so divided within himself. That is his essence. That is his reason for being, you might say. He's not this or that. He does have contradictory urges, and he is intuitively shrewd enough to recognize these pulls, separate pulls within his own character.
But within that, he's always his own man. He always is true to the impulses even when they seem to contradict each other. I can almost feel in reading the novel that Conrad had difficulty evoking him at first. I feel that he's forced in the first part of the book because the history of Costaguana is recalled for us, and here and there throughout all the scenes of turmoil and such, suddenly the one figure that everyone is looking to for firmness and for ability to handle a situation is Nostromo. He keeps being pulled in too miraculously.
Well, we have here a character who is incorruptible, who's altogether a man of extraordinary prowess. He's brave. He has many resources which he can capitalize upon in different situations. He is perhaps too proud of his name. He's full of conceit. He wants, for example, to make a name for himself. He wants a reputation for success. Now, since he wants that reputation, he will permit people to use him, introduce him to situations which give him an opportunity to explore his resources. But at the same time, he's always somewhat reluctant to be used. I don't have the feeling that that he always acts, as you suggested a moment ago, in the way that he wants. I have a feeling there's a good deal of psychological coercion here, almost compulsion. On the one hand, to receive recognition, and yet on the other hand, deploring the situations in which he finds himself.
I think it's this vanity that he has is what I was actually concerned with. And that is, I think, one of the best touches about the character, in that he does recognize his own capacities completely, and is not at all shy about letting other people know about them. But when he acts under coercion, still he is acting for his own motives, for his own benefit.
Yes, preen his vanity, in a sense. Now, the situation which gives the greatest insight into this divided personality is when he's asked to save the silver. And he knows that the people have come to him because he has a reputation for success. He knows that he's being used, and he will gladly, almost enthusiastically, you might say, assent to the proposition. But in the situation, he thinks to himself, I know I'm being used. Now, once the adventure has proved successful, he gets away with the silver, he buries it, and his accomplice later on commits suicide. That leaves him the sole proprietor of the silver. Now, why doesn't he, with all of his great pride and his honesty and his integrity, why doesn't he confess to the fact that he has it, instead of growing rich gradually by taking an ingot a month at a time and misleading the people that he really does not have the silver, and that he's that he is coming by his fortune through his enterprise and industry in the present situation?
I think that's the fascinating complexity of the character. First of all, in being used and recognizing it, I don't feel that he is resentful of this particularly, in that being used is also to his own advantage. He recognizes that. Then the silver becomes the crucial thing as far as testing his real incorruptibility.
Yes. One of the poignant moments in the novel for me is when he confesses to Giselle that the barrier between them is a treasure. Now, he doesn't go all the way in revealing to her his ownership or how he has come by the silver. But when she interrogates him and says, "How did you get it?" he says, "I'm a thief." Now, in that moment, I think you see the veneer peeled away. Now, are you to say that he is essentially a thief, or is he, as all the other people see him, utterly incorruptible, or partly incorruptible? Which?
Well, he is. There, I almost have some trepidation that Conrad is really tied by his source. He mentions in his note at the beginning of the novel that he was dealing with a real story, only in that particular case the man who had managed to hide away the whole barge load of silver was a thorough scoundrel, even to confessing it openly to one person and then boasting deliberately, saying, "You can't tell on me, because if you do, no one will believe you."
The Conrad editorializes at one moment in the novel, describing Nostromo, and he has this to say: "A transgression, a crime, entering a man's existence, eats it up like a malignant growth, consumes it like a fever. Nostromo had lost his peace. The genuineness of all his qualities was destroyed, and he recognizes himself, quote, as a sham," unquote. Now, do you have a feeling, Tom, that the novel really demonstrates that this transgression is a malignant growth, and it does suborn his entire character?
I think that doesn't emerge clearly as I'd like it to. I have a feeling there again that it's forced in the set of circumstances, including Nostromo's death by accident, by sheer mistaken identity.
Isn't it the thing that Conrad does in so many of in the characterization of so many of his protagonists? He will give them a kind of guilt, and that guilt is their daily crucifixion.
Yes, and so often an unjustified guilt. The guilt is so much greater than the sin that one is feeling guilt for.
The guilt can only be identified, though, or explained, in terms of the, well, let's say, original integrity of the character, or what he thinks himself to be.
Well, that's, I think, of course, is his purpose, to try to reveal what the integrity of the personality is. But Conrad's preoccupation with his characters, I think, is pretty well revealed in that introductory note to the novel. He says there, "The history of men on this earth since the beginning of ages may be resumed in one phrase of infinite poignancy. They were born, they suffered, they died. Yet it is a great tale. But in the infinitely minute stories about men and women it is my lot on earth to narrate, I am not capable of such detachment." And it's this preoccupation, this commitment to his characters, that leads him to probe them in this way. They're always worth it. They are good characters. They are good people.
You've been listening to Offered with Comment. Offered with Comment is produced and moderated by Professors Arthur Wills and Thomas Mutch. The subject of next week's program will be William Golding's Lord of the Flies. Offered with Comment is directed by Don Wheeler and originated in the studios of KUAC on the campus at College. This is the University of Alaska Broadcasting Service.